This week on The Score, political scientist Mark Rozelle previews the 2018 midterm elections. Electoral board member Jim Heilman looks at elections in Afghanistan. Documentary filmmaker Mark Herzog recalls 1968. Attorney Elliot Harding sues to protect Second Amendment rights. All that and more on The Score. Stay tuned.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Remember the 6th of November. Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere, and Election Day is barely 3 days away. As recently as 10 years ago, Virginia was seen as reliably Republican in both national and statewide elections. Virginia had not voted for a Democratic presidential nominee since 1964, but that changed in 2008 when the state went for Barack Obama, which it did again in 2012, and in 2016, Virginia was the only southern state to vote for Hillary Clinton. Republicans have not won a statewide race since 2009. In this year's congressional elections, there are competitive races in districts designed to favor Republicans, notably the 5th District, which has an open seat, and the 7th, where incumbent Dave Bratt is defending solid Republican territory against Democratic challenger Abigail Spanberger and potential Libertarian spoiler Joe Walton. Our first guest this week is political scientist Mark Rozelle, who is Dean of the Schar School of Government and Policy at George Mason University in Northern Virginia. In my conversation with Dr. Rozelle, we look at the races in Virginia's 5th, 7th, and 10th congressional districts and explore whether Virginia might be a bellwether state, one that matches or foretells the outcomes of elections elsewhere in the United States. I spoke with Mark Rozelle in his office on October 31st, 6 days before Election Day, about the 2018 midterm elections for Congress. When we last met, it was in mid-June, just after the party primaries, and you gave sort of a tour of the landscape of the upcoming elections. Have your views on what's going to happen on November 6th changed at all in the past 3 months or so?
My views have not changed a great deal. I still think this is going to be a very strong year for the Democrats, and certainly that's what people have been projecting all year long. The president's approval ratings have gone up somewhat significantly. That suggests that some of the races that may have been competitive before have moved a little bit more in the Republicans' direction. But if you look at the overall numbers of competitive races nationally for the House of Representatives, how many are held by Republicans, how many are held by Democrats, it's really much greater opportunity in this election cycle for Democrats to make significant pickups in the House of Representatives. For the Republicans, things are looking better in the Senate. And that's just simply because of the math, that there are not enough competitive races, and the ones that are there, it's mostly Democrats who are vulnerable.
We're talking with Mark Rozelle, a political scientist and dean of the Schar School at George Mason University here in Northern Virginia. Let's talk a little bit about Virginia. Your school just did a poll. Mm-hmm. What do the numbers look like, especially in the 10th District where Barbara Comstock is running against Jennifer Wexton?
Right. So the Washington Post Schar School poll focused on the 10th district, and it showed a substantial lead for the Democrat, Jennifer Wexton, over incumbent Barbara Comstock. It showed a significant gender gap, of course, a generational gap, an education gap. It showed much greater enthusiasm among potential Democratic voters than Republican voters. And most significantly, it showed a huge gap in favor of Wexton among independent voters. So the Democratic-leaning voters are way over 90%. going for Wexton. The Republican identifying voters are well over 90%, but not quite as high, going for Comstock. And then the independent voters are going very heavily for Wexton. So that's Comstock's problem in running for re-election, is trying to broaden her base beyond the Republican base voters. There's not enough Republicans in that district to carry her. So she needs those extra votes outside of the core constituency of pro-Trump and pro-Republican voters. And the polling data suggests she's not getting it, but something can change, of course, by Election Day.
Now, 2 years ago, Barbara Comstock ran well ahead of President Trump in that district.
Yep.
What's changed?
What's changed is that President Trump became president, right? And that's most significant, because in the 2016 election cycle, it was a theoretical but unlikely possibility in the minds of most voters that Donald Trump would win the presidency. So what we saw in that election cycle is actually, in the 10th District of Virginia, a lot of split-ticket voting. The district went heavily for Hillary Clinton, and Republican Barbara Comstock easily won re-election by a very comfortable margin. And so that showed that Comstock had political appeal that went beyond the base Republican and Trump-supporting voters in that district. And remember, she even won the endorsement of the Washington Post in that election cycle, which is quite unusual for a Republican in this region to achieve. But in this election cycle, what's changed is that Donald Trump is president. The Democrats have stuck to the point that Barbara Comstock has been a reliable pro-Trump voter on policy for these 2 years. And there's a lot of Democratic and independent voter discontent, anger projected toward this presidency. They don't have Donald Trump on the ballot to vote against, but they can vote against a person with an R next to her name. And so I think through no fault of her own, there are certain factors in this election cycle that are driving voters away from the Republican incumbent that she has really nothing to do with.
There are a couple of other districts in Virginia I'd like to pick your brain on. I don't know whether you've looked at them closely, but they're both very close races. In the 5th District, which is an open seat, Republican Denver Riggleman against Democrat Leslie Coburn. I understand that Riggleman's internal polls show him ahead by 10 points, but the independent polling shows a dead heat. Why would that be?
Right. I don't tend to trust internal polls as much as the independent ones, so unless they have some information that all the other polling entities around the state have missed, I would probably look more carefully and consider more reliable the independent polls that have been done there. But it is a Republican-leaning district, so one would expect that it is a tough challenge for a Democrat to win there unless there is a very big blue wave in this election cycle, which is quite possible.
And in the Virginia 7th District, mm-hmm. incumbent Republican Dave Bratt is running against Abigail Spanberger. Mm-hmm. There's a Libertarian in the race, Joe Walton, who's a former elected office holder. Right now, the polls look like it's within the margin of error. So what do you foretell for that district?
Yes. That's another example where you have a more Republican-leaning district, and yet the polling data show that the election is very, very close. And possibly the Libertarian candidate is taking away a little bit more of the votes from the Republican incumbent than from the Democratic challenger in that district. But I think it's going to be a really close race, actually. Bratt is not an entirely popular incumbent, for one thing. He won a very unexpected victory in the Republican primary against a strong incumbent that nobody expected to happen. And he's got a strong challenger. And again, if this is a Democratic blue wave election cycle, we could end up with a result that under other circumstances we would not expect to happen in that district, which is a Democrat actually winning.
Do you think that Virginia is a bellwether state for the rest of the country? If we watch returns coming in from Virginia, will we be able to make more or less accurate predictions about what Congress is going to look like in 2019?
I think if you see in the 5th and 7th districts that the Democratic candidates are pulling a victory and Wexton is winning a substantial majority in the 10th district, that would tell a lot about what's happening in the country. Absolutely. The Senate race, forget it. That's really not going to tell much at all, because it really is not, according to the independent polls, a very competitive race at this point. And in fact, I think what the Republicans are worried about there is that the top of the ticket, Corey Stewart, the nominee for the U.S. Senate, is going to be a drag on the candidates in the House races.
Yeah, I think there's a worry that some Republicans are going to stay at home because they don't want to vote for Corey Stewart, so they also won't be voting for the Republican congressional candidates.
Right. I've heard that as well, and that's a big worry. Or that voters will go to the polls to vote against the candidate who has run the most overtly pro-Trump campaign of just about any candidate in this election cycle. And when they go to the polls, they may vote down ticket as well against the Republicans. So I know many Republicans are saying privately, and some are actually saying it publicly, that they're concerned that Corey Stewart is going to be a drag on the Republican ticket throughout the state. And in those close races that we just discussed, it could make a significant difference.
Looking at the polls nationwide, what do you think these recent incidents of domestic terrorism are going to have on the electorate going into Tuesday?
It's hard to predict what the political impact will be of these horrible events of the past week, but certainly there was a great deal of criticism, rightfully so, I believe, projected against the president regarding how he has responded to these terrible tragedies. And that can't help the Republican brand. That, I think, is going to have some impact on voter participation and in some close races, and it's probably, most likely, not going to be good for the Republican Party.
Just to wrap up, if you were going to predict the ultimate outcome mm-hmm. in the House and the Senate, who do you think is going to have the majorities in those houses coming January 3rd?
On the Senate, I think it's highly likely the Republicans are going to maintain their majority, and that's just a simple matter of math, given the number of competitive races where Democrats are trying to protect seats as opposed to Republicans. The numbers very much favor the Republicans there. But on the House of Representatives side, I think the numbers very much favor the Democrats. So the Washington Post Char School poll showed that there are 69 competitive races out of the 435.
And that's a huge number.
That is a big number. Absolutely right. That is a very big number. Usually we have very, very few competitive races in the House of Representatives, which is a really big problem in this country. But this is a very different, unique kind of election cycle. But out of those 69 districts, only six are held by a Democrat. So in all the districts that have been projected by independent observers, the Cook Political Report and others, as having a chance of turning one way or the other, it's a 10-to-1 ratio being held by Republicans as opposed to Democrats. So if Democrats merely pick up one half of the competitive races, they have substantially more than what they need to gain a majority in the House of Representatives. They just need to flip 23. So I think the Democrats are probably going to pick up a significant number of House seats. The Republicans have pretty much decided that's lost already. And the only question is just how large that number is going to be of Democratic pickups in the House.
Are there any races across the country that you predict will have a surprising ending on Tuesday night, something that people are not currently predicting, but that you are reading the tea leaves and see a different result?
I'm going out on a limb here. I'm going to say that the gubernatorial races in both Georgia and in Florida will go Democrat.
That's a good way to end the conversation. Mark Rozelle, thank you for joining us again on The Score from Bearing Drift. It's always a pleasure to meet with you, and I hope that we'll have a chance to meet again, maybe in January, as Congress is putting itself together.
I'd be happy to do it. Thank you, Rick.
You're listening to The Score from Bearing Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
As this episode of The Score goes on the air, movie lovers from around the country and around the world have gathered in Charlottesville for the 31st Annual Virginia Film Festival. This year's festival features more than 150 films over 4 days, with special guests that include Oscar-winning actor Christoph Waltz, director Peter Bogdanovich, and a member of the Virginia House of Delegates, former journalist Chris Hurst. On Thursday evening, the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia hosted a screening of portions of the four-part documentary film series 1968, The Year That Changed America. After the film was shown, producer and director Mark Herzog took part in a panel discussion about how the film was made and what topics were included and excluded. Immediately after that panel, I spoke to Herzog in the green room backstage at the Culbreth Theater. To ask some more questions about the documentary filmmaking process and whether making documentaries is a form of journalism.
And I'd like to start off with sort of a general question, and then we'll get into what we just looked at. A few weeks ago, Anne Hornaday wrote in the Washington Post asking the question, are documentary filmmakers journalists? She went back and forth on it, and in the end she said no. What do you think is the answer to that question?
Anne Hornaday, by the way, did an interview with us for the 2000s. I believe depends on who you are as a documentarian. Personally, we follow journalistic practices. All documentarians make a choice. We made a choice to find this footage, that footage. We made a choice to put in the moment when Nixon says, you know, I want to bring respect to the, obviously we did that for a reason. So there are certain things that go beyond purely being journalistic, but even journalists make choices in what they report about. So I think it really depends on the type of documentary you're making, but we certainly follow journalistic practices. I would not say I'm a journalist, but we adhere to that.
That's a good segue to my next question, which we just looked at a four-part series just about 1968. Well, very busy year. I noticed a lot of stuff you left out, like the Soviet invasion of Hungary. And I'm sure in your earlier episodes you talk about the Tet Offensive. But how many hours of archival footage did you look at to reduce it to just under 4 hours of a documentary film?
I would say, we go to different stock houses. We go to the big three networks, ABC, NBC, CBS were around at the time, and sift through their archives. So, and that's a lot of lists, a lot of, you know, you might type in, okay, I want everything on Nixon from that year, and it'll give that. And then you look through, the team looks through, I'd say hundreds, if not thousands of hours to put this together to find those moments.
I can imagine you spent a lot of time in places like the Paley Center in Beverly Hills.
Well, actually, everything's really, we do it mostly online. We do it from our place. But Paley Center is, we're definitely, we've utilized, we've accessed them for sure.
Mm-hmm.
The archives at Vanderbilt.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
A lot of times, if a news organization forgot to record something or catalog it or, you know, threw it away, a lot of times they taped over it, videotape at the time.
Oh, yeah.
The archives at Vanderbilt have been great about recording almost every newscast, and most of this is built on newscasts. By the way, we did have the Tet Offensive in there in our winter, and then we do talk about the Soviet invasion just briefly. I mean, we didn't really go international, but we talked about it.
Yeah, that must have been a big part of your choices, is what to emphasize. You have a very limited amount of time. If you could have a 20-hour documentary, it would look very different.
Well, it's not Ken Burns with 18 hours of Vietnam.
Right.
Which they probably could have done another, you know, 10 hours.
Exactly.
On that, you know?
They were here last year at the Virginia Film
Festival.
Oh, they
were. Oh, great.
Not Ken Burns, but his associate producer.
Yeah.
In your process, do you do the interviews first and then follow up with finding the footage that fits what's being talked about, or is it here and there in both directions?
In our process, we read a lot of books first. Distinguish who are the historians, the book authors that we want to go after. Distinguish who are the people who lived through it that we want to go after, and make outreach to them. At the same time, the team is now sifting through the footage and compiling what would be an outline. What do we really want to say in this episode? And then very shortly after, before we've even started editing, we're already interviewing. We've hopefully marinated our heads in the subject, and we start the process. We mostly interview in New York, D.C., and L.A. That's where we're based. Certainly, if it's political, almost everybody else is in New York and D.C. And so it's all happening at the same time. A lot of times they'll do an initial structure, like an outline on video, like a timeline, we call it. That's bare bones. We may have five great interviews that help us shape the show, knowing that we're going to get another 25 interviews. They're going to really flesh it out.
So. And how long does it take from conception to putting it on TV? What's the general timeline?
This took about a year.
I would have expected longer.
No, we're actually fast compared to something like Ken Burns. They definitely take their time. What was Vietnam? 10 years? 12
yeah,
years? Something like that?
15, I think.
15, yeah. The Decade series, which is about 8 hours, we can do in about 10 months, mostly because we have we have a team that knows what they're looking for and how to do it. That's still hard. Don't get me wrong. It still breaks us every time. In terms of 1968, this just, you know, took a little while to sort of sift through all the things. And even though it's only 4 hours, Decade series used about eight. By the time we finished it and handed it in and took things out and swapped them, some things out, it still was about a year.
My last question is referring to the editorial process. What was left out that you really would have liked to have got in there if you had another 5 minutes?
There are certainly some films that I would have loved to have talked about, specifically from a cultural standpoint. We are lucky to be doing for CNN right now a series called The Movies, which is 12 hours on the history of movies. That's coming out next summer. And so I'm able to get back into some of those movies. There were some cultural moments that we didn't get to. There's some international moments. I think there was a drought in Biafra. Do I have that right?
There was a famine in Biafra in 1968 because of the Civil War.
Right. Things like that we never really got to. I interviewed Morley Safer, and he talked about that. We didn't really put him in this, but there were certain things he was talking about. I would have loved gotten much more into Prague and all the things that were going on there. So there's certain moments that we couldn't get to. Again, 4 hours is great. It's better than the 1 hour you had in the 60s. It's still not enough time.
And you could have done this whole thing just on the election campaign.
Sure.
And the other stuff would have been another documentary.
Right, right, exactly.
But I appreciate your being here at the Virginia Film Festival, and I'm glad we had a chance to talk
today.
Well,
thank you to the Miller Center for curating this part and bringing me here.
Oh, they always do a good job of bringing a film that's relevant to the festival.
Yeah, great.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Did you miss the previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BearingDrift.com.
When The Score returns, we'll hear from Jim Heilman, Secretary of the Albemarle County Electoral Board, who has stories to tell about helping run elections in Afghanistan. And Elliot Harding returns to talk about his latest legal adventure, suing the federal government to expand the Second Amendment. Don't go away. The Score will be right back.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BeringDrift.com.
Welcome back to The Score. I'm Rick Sincere. This is a busy election year. Congressional elections in Virginia and the United States are only a small part. In recent weeks, there was a presidential election in Brazil, parliamentary elections in Gabon, a referendum to repeal Ireland's blasphemy law, and local elections in Germany. There are also parliamentary elections going on in Afghanistan. The Score's next guest, Jim Heilman, has traveled the world to organize and monitor elections in emerging democracies. He's also Secretary of the Electoral Board in Albemarle County, Virginia. I asked Jim about his experiences in helping Afghanistan run the country's first Democratic elections in 40 years.
The past week or so has been very busy for elections around the world. Presidential election in Brazil, a referendum on blasphemy in Ireland, and a presidential election there as well, regional elections in Germany, and ongoing elections in Afghanistan, which have been delayed in part because of violence. You have been in Afghanistan for previous elections. You helped set them up, I guess, about 8 years ago. What was it like on the ground there? Americans complain a lot about how difficult it is to vote. What about Afghans?
Well, the first Afghan election after we invaded Afghanistan was in 2004. There had not been any kind of election in Afghanistan for 40 years before that. And so there were lots of big challenges to putting on that first election. It was a presidential election in 2004, and lots of logistical issues involved in doing it.
We're talking to Jim Heilman, who's a member of the Albemarle County Electoral Board, Secretary of the Electoral Board, former General Registrar in Albemarle County, but also a very experienced observer and facilitator of elections overseas. You just mentioned that you've been in Bosnia recently. What was it like in Afghanistan? You said people hadn't voted for 40 years. What did it take to acculturate them into the idea of voting for their leaders and getting them to the polls and also just setting up the logistics of things, you know, things that we take for granted in the United States?
Well, first, the setting up, because there was no election infrastructure in Afghanistan. We had to create it, we meaning the international community. And so we created an election management body, an international election management body, that consisted of, I think it was 8 Afghans, and they were called the Afghan Election Commission, and 8 international election experts. And the 16 of them, if I remember the number correctly, they were going to be voting on the policy and the setup and all that. One of my first jobs over there was mentoring those 8 Afghans. And it's Afghan, not Afghani. Afghani is the money. Afghans are the people. Because they had never seen an election before, and they were going to have to vote on all sorts of different matters pertaining to organizing the election that they knew nothing about. So my job was to mentor them on things that were going to be upcoming votes that they would have to take so that they had some idea of what they were voting on along with the international community. And that was a very interesting thing to do. The logistics, wow. Here we had a country that, number one, had never seen an election for 40 years. Number two, is very widespread with mountainous regions and extremely rural villages. How are you going to get ballot papers and ballot boxes out to some of these villages? A logistical nightmare. We used helicopters, fixed-wing aircraft, camels, donkeys, whatever was available to get things out to them. And then issues like how are the people actually going to mark a ballot? Because many of these rural villages, people had never held a pen or a pencil before. So are we going to have them do it with a pen, or are we going to have them do it with their thumbprint? So lots of issues were involved in putting on that first election in 2004. It was only for president, and it actually went fairly well, partially because the Afghans were naive to elections, meaning they did not see how to commit electoral fraud. So that first election was pretty much fraud-free. The biggest issue of the election, and actually 2 p.m. in the afternoon, 12 of the candidates for president all got together and issued a boycott of the election. Never mind, the election was going to be over in 2 more hours because of the pens. There were marking pens with indelible ink for marking people's fingers so they wouldn't vote twice, and then there were marking pens that were not indelible for marking the ballots. Well, the people had never seen the pens, the poll workers, and when they opened up their materials, all these pens were labeled in English. They didn't speak English. They didn't know which pen was the indelible one and which one wasn't. So that got all confused, and people thought there was great fraud about these pens when really it was just a glitch on the part of the UN at that time.
And you also have the problem of Afghanistan being a multilingual, multi-ethnic country. Did that mean that the ballots had to be printed in multiple languages, or did you use non-linguistic ways of indicating the candidates, like pictures or symbols?
The first one, the presidential election, each candidate got their own symbol, whatever symbol they wanted. And so there was a picture of the candidate, the name of the candidate, and I believe we only did that in one language, but it's an Arabic language. All of them are semi-Arabic languages, so they write fairly much the same. So they had a symbol, a picture, and their name. And that's the way we did it. Now, coming to the next year, we finally had parliamentary elections in 2005. That was somewhat of a mess, because in 2004, they still hadn't adopted an electoral system. How were they going to elect their parliament? And Americans don't know much about electoral systems. I bet 99% of Americans could not tell you what the name of our system is. It's FPTP, First Past the Post. That's used in about half the countries around the world, but then there are other systems that are used. And Hamid Karzai, against all the internationals lobbying for him to adopt a reasonable system, adopted something, and his big advisor was our ambassador, Khalilzad, who he had dinner with. They were childhood friends. They dined together every night. He advised him on everything, except he wouldn't advise him on this. And they adopted a system, Hamid Karzai did, called the single non-transferable vote, which was only used in the Kingdom of Jordan, Vanuatu, a Pacific island, and the Pitcairn Islands with a population of 52. It is a system that makes no sense. Everybody gets to run. Ballot access is very easy. But if you have, let's say, a province like Kabul, which was electing 30 people to their parliament, everybody was on the ballot, but you could only vote for one person. You couldn't vote for 30 people. You could only vote for one. We told them this system was going to be really bad. It does not promote parties at all. Because let's say your party wants to put forth 10 candidates. One of them's really, really, really popular. Everybody votes for that one candidate, and your other 9 candidates don't get any votes. So you only get one person elected. And we had over 300 people on the ballot in the Kabul province running for the parliament. And once again, they had a number, they had a symbol, they had their face, and they had their name. You can imagine the size of the ballot.
I cannot just imagine it. I remember seeing it when you brought it back to Charlottesville after the election, and I think that ballot paper was about the size of an old highway map.
Yeah, or bigger. But they ended up using sort of a news magazine kind of format. But to count them, you had to go through all these pages with all these candidates to try to find, make sure there's only one mark, and then take that page and count that. It took 6 weeks to count the ballots for that election.
Now, you haven't been to the Afghanistan recently, as far as I know. Do you think that they have improved on the system that was developed 10, 15 years ago?
No, they have not improved on the system, and people discovered how to game the system. So when I was there in 2009 for the elections, I was staff to the Electoral Complaints Commission, which was run by a good friend of mine, a Canadian, who ended up working for Paul Manafort in Ukraine. But that's for another show. And as staff, I fielded 2,864 official complaints for that election. A lot of them were silly. One I saved was that the candidate slaughtered a sheep outside the polling station and fed the meat to the voters. Well, that was a smart candidate, I think. And then a lot of them were very substantive. And ended up, over 1 million votes were thrown out in that election because of fraud. Ballot stuffing was just happening all over the place. You'd find 50 ballots all neatly stacked together with the exact same mark on every ballot. Ballot stuffing. So they've realized how to commit fraud that continues on. The election that was just held October 20th, and then the a couple provinces couldn't even do it then. I'm sure there's a lot of fraud that went on in those. And those were the first ones that were really run almost solely by Afghans. And I've talked to some colleagues that said that, unfortunately, they were probably the worst of all the elections that we've had in Afghanistan.
Well, we have about 15 or 20 seconds left. What's your next foreign adventure? What other countries might you be helping on elections in the near future?
Oh, I don't know. Probably won't do one for another year or so, but I've done lots of elections in Ukraine, Kyrgyzstan, and other places. So wherever I can go, I'll go.
That sounds great. Jim Hamlin, thank you for joining us on The Score. We'll be back to you if there are more issues like this to talk about in the near future.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
Elliot Harding has been a guest on The Score at least twice before. He's an attorney in Charlottesville and is always looking for ways to expand the legal envelope. Last week, Harding announced that he was suing the federal government on behalf of two young adults whose Second Amendment rights are circumscribed by a law that prohibits them from buying handguns, from a licensed gun dealers at least. In this interview, he explains the reasoning behind the lawsuit and what the next steps will be.
Today the topic is the Second Amendment. What is the issue that you are going to federal court to defend the constitutional rights of a couple of people under the age of 21 in Charlottesville?
Yes. Yeah, so in the case, we have Hirschfeld against Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and as well as Jeff Sessions, Attorney General for the United States. And I'm representing two young adults who are petitioning the court to strike down what is the federal ban on the sale of handguns to young adults, those being over 18 but under 21, by federally licensed firearm dealers, which make up a significant majority of firearm dealers in the United States. Currently, the U.S. Code allows these young adults to purchase rifles and shotguns from these dealers, but not handguns. And the law actually does allow these young adults to own these firearms, own the handguns, receive them from and buy them from friends or family or any other private transaction. But that private transaction is devoid of any background check, and also, of course, limits the types of firearms that can be bought. They're inherently used or pre-owned, and a lot of other things that are limited, and therefore we've brought this suit in the Charlottesville Division of the Western District of Virginia. It's a federal suit, and we're arguing both Second Amendment violations as well as Fifth Amendment equal protection violations based on the age discrimination component.
We're talking to crusading attorney Elliot Harding, who seems to be the go-to guy in Albemarle County for the constitutional rights of plaintiffs on a number of issues. Let me play devil's advocate and ask whether this is ripe for a federal lawsuit. Isn't this something that could be addressed through legislation?
It absolutely could be addressed through legislation. The U.S. Code could be fixed. They could remove this provision. It's 18 U.S.C. 922, I think. Might be 921. I got to think off the top of my head. But it could be fixed through legislation. That'd be great. But in the meantime, we have a law that's violating the Constitution. And so the most effective way to go after that is to get the courts to speak through the Constitution and issue an injunction after a declaratory judgment.
Second devil's advocate question. Mm-hmm. The late Justice Antonin Scalia, in his majority opinion in Heller versus D.C., said that the Second Amendment allows for reasonable regulations. Mm-hmm. 21 is the nationally mandated drinking age, even though it was done through the back door.
Sure.
Isn't this a reasonable regulation that does not violate the Second Amendment?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. First, let me speak to Scalia's comments in Heller. We would argue that it is inherently unreasonable to ban a fundamental liberty to a law-abiding adult citizen for no reason but for their age. This is not just any regulation. This is an outright, we would say, an undue burden on the exercise of that fundamental liberty here. And if you want to go from an originalist perspective, 18-year-olds were certainly making up a significant portion of the Revolutionary Army, making up the cognizable militia at that time. And one of the plaintiffs here, you know, makes up the militia now as a member of the Selective Service. He could be drafted and sent overseas and be using that firearm, but then come home, not be able to purchase it from a licensed dealer. And again, we need to focus on the fact that it's not an outright ban. They are allowed to possess these weapons and purchase these weapons from back alley sales. And that's really where it's unreasonable and illogical at its fundamental level. Now, we're talking about the drinking age. I think we all recognize drinking being more of a privilege and an act, you know, commercial activity, substance, something that can be regulated at the state level. You've got the 18th Amendment and other considerations that came after that. But when it comes to a fundamental liberty like the Second Amendment protects, that being the right to self-defense, that has a much higher bar and much more stringent protections.
I would argue that the right to control your own body is also a fundamental liberty, but there are people in Congress and other legislatures that disagree with that. On the legislative level, do you think that this might get some pushback from people who say, this is another loophole that people who are under the age of 21 can acquire these weapons from anyone except a licensed firearms dealer, and then they will move to close that so-called loophole?
Well, the closing of the loophole being hopefully they fix it so that you can buy it from the licensed dealers, because that's a space where, granted, you have these background checks, but you also have much better supply and you have the newer weapons rather than pre-owned, and you have trusted dealers with reputation. So it's a win-win, I think, if the legislation could be fixed. But in the meantime, we certainly think it's illogical, unreasonable, and unconstitutional. I think another big thing behind this suit that people need to realize is there are states right now that are trying to raise the age to 21 for the purchase of all of the other weapons, the long guns, the shotguns, and the rifles. You've got California and Florida mentioning that. Even after the wake of Parkland shootings down in Florida, the President of the United States mentioned that he'd be open to signing that type of legislation at a federal level. So I think the timing is something that's important as we see these states trying to infringe on the Second Amendment. We need to lower the floor so that these law-abiding adults can protect themselves.
Have your plaintiffs, who I guess are two people from the Charlottesville area, have they attempted to purchase a weapon from a licensed dealer?
Yes, they both have. They both went to two different stores. There are two different types of handguns they want. One wanted a revolver, one wanted just a Ruger American pistol. And they both were denied, obviously. They both have different reasons why they want the firearms. One of the plaintiffs has a very sympathetic story where she's a young woman who has a protective order out against an ex-boyfriend who has a history of abuse, has been detained for having a firearm while on the protective order, didn't show up for court, and then was out and about with a known firearm. And she works in a rural area with horses every day, and she's alone sometimes, and she's thinking to herself, I shouldn't be relegated to running and finding the shotgun or finding the assault rifle. I should be able to have an open carry pistol on my hip during these times.
Could this provision of the law also be seen as a limitation on the firearms dealers to be able to do business with whomever they like? And would they be open to joining your lawsuit?
Dealers certainly do fall within the ambit of those who are being infringed on in this case. It's as well as larger organizations. So this challenge has been brought once, to my knowledge, about 6 or 7 years ago, down in a federal court in Texas. And in that suit, some dealers were part of the plaintiff class as well. But it made its way to the Fifth Circuit. They lost, and then the en banc was denied 7-6, and it was never pushed anywhere else since then. And I think that the logic of the courts there was unsound. I think that the arguments could be refined and brought to a light that's more amenable to the plaintiffs in today's suit.
So you filed the lawsuit. What's the next step?
The government will be served. They'll have some time to file an answer. They'll likely try to file a motion to dismiss. We will likely see it wrap up into a summary judgment motion, because the facts really, I would argue, and I'm sure the defense will probably agree, aren't that debatable. This is truly a declaratory judgment, so it's on the law rather than a factual dispute. So hopefully we have a quick resolution here at the district court level. And then win or lose, I'd imagine that either party would seek to put it up to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and that will take several months. So it's going to be a long time of litigation, but we'll wait and see what the government's response is and the type of arguments they bring.
What happens if you're plaintiffs age out while you're litigating?
Well, I'd imagine that one of them probably will. He's 20, will turn 21 in July of 2019. So he would be rendered, it would be rendered moot as to him. But one of the other plaintiffs is 18. She'll likely remain in the age range through the duration of litigation. And then, of course, we've already been contacted by other young adults who are interested in joining. And at a later date, there very well may be a second complaint or an amended complaint to bring in new parties as well.
Well, Elliot Harding, thanks for joining us on The Score again. I never know what you're going to be pulling out of your hat, but I'm glad you're here today and able to talk to us about the Second Amendment.
Awesome. Thanks, Rick.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BeringDrift.com.
Since we had one guest this week from the current Virginia Film Festival, I looked back to find an interview on a related topic from an earlier festival. I found a conversation with law professor Brian Fry, a producer of the 2013 CNN documentary, Our Nixon, which compiles clips of home movies taken by Richard Nixon's White House aides, John Ehrlichman, H.R. Haldeman, and Dwight Chapin. It turns out that Dwight Chapin is one of the talking heads in Mark Herzog's documentary about 1968. From the archives, here's Brian L. Fry from the Virginia Film Festival in November 2013.
Brian Fry, you're producer of Our Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
Could you first start by telling me about your academic interest in film and what kind of scholarly pursuit you have?
Well, I started my my educational career as a film student. So I went to undergrad at UC Berkeley, where I studied film studies. And then I went to the San Francisco Art Institute, where I did an MFA in filmmaking, after which I moved to New York in 97. And for about 4 or 5 years, I ran a weekly experimental film series called the Robert Beck Memorial Cinema. I also made movies at the time, short experimental films that I showed, you know, all around the world, including in the Whitney Biennial 2002. And at the same time, I was writing film criticism quite a bit for a lot of magazines, including Senses of Cinema and Millennium Film Journal and Film Comment, Cineast, et cetera, et cetera. I then went to law school had a career at Sullivan & Cromwell briefly as a securities lawyer. But at the same time, I was still very involved in the film world. After leaving Sullivan & Cromwell, I went into legal academia. I'm currently a professor, an assistant professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law, where I teach intellectual property, nonprofits, and art law-related classes. So my academic scholarship is bound up in, you know, the film world, both institutionally and thinking about films as historical documents aesthetic aspects of them, issues relating to film and copyright especially.
I'm going to ask you to repeat something you said on the panel discussion, but how did you discover this archival material from the Nixon White House?
Right. So the story with the films was that they were Haldeman, at least the best we can surmise, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Chapin were receiving free Super 8 film from the Naval Photographic Center and also free processing and printing. So I'm pretty sure that what was happening was Haldeman was distributing the films, and then after they were shot, he was collecting them, dropping them off at the Naval Photographic Center, and then providing prints to all of his friends, right? So they probably got three prints of everything, more or less. So when Ehrlichman resigned, he left in his office a print of the Super 8 films, second and third generation prints, and those were confiscated and ultimately became part of the Watergate investigation collection that went to the National Archives, so they were placed into the public domain in that way. But because they don't really relate to the abuse of power issues that people were most interested in, they were relatively low priority on the kind of preservation ladder, and they weren't preserved until 2000, and it just so happens that the person who did the film preservation was a person I was working with at Hampshire College at the time, and so he told me about his preservation work and showed me one of the reels, which I thought was fascinating, but I didn't have the resources to make transfers at the time, so these were preserved, but there weren't access copies available. So then in 2000, in the interim, I wrote an article for Cineast about them based on primary source material, mostly newspaper discussions of Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Chapin filming the president. That's on the rnixon.com website if you want to check it out. And then in 2008, when I met Penny Lane, I told her about the project, and we jointly decided that we would collaborate on making the film. But at the time, we didn't actually know what
the movies look like, because all we had seen was that one 400-foot, like one 10-minute section that I had seen many years earlier. So we paid for the National Archives to make a video transfer. It cost about $20,000, and we did that sight unseen, hoping, fingers crossed, that there was a movie there. And we got the film. We spent about 2 weeks watching them and thinking about what kind of movie they could make, and we realized right away that the movie that we saw in those home movies was the story of the Nixon presidency as experienced by Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Chapin. And that just struck us as a kind of an interesting, novel, potentially compelling way to look at the nature of a president. Sometimes I like to say, you know, people say you can learn a lot about a person by the way they talk to the waiter. And, you know, maybe you can learn something about the president from the way he talks to his staff members.
Let me track back for a moment. You said that the films were confiscated from Ehrlichman's office as part of the Watergate investigation.
Mm-hmm.
What was their evidentiary value?
Well, everything was confiscated. Basically, it's an interesting story with the Nixon presidential materials. At the time Nixon was president, the assumption, the legal assumption, was that all of the records and documents and materials produced by an administration were the personal private property of the president. So when Nixon resigned, he asked the archivist to basically box everything up in the White House and send it to his house in San Clemente. And when the Attorney General found out and told the Watergate special prosecutor, they stopped them from doing it, and ultimately impounded the material. And within a few weeks, Congress had passed a special statute nationalizing all of the materials created by the Nixon White House. They basically said everything that the Nixon administration created is now the property of the United States government. And if that's a Fifth Amendment taking, then we will compensate the Nixon estate, but we're not deciding in advance whether it is. So Richard Nixon himself actually filed a lawsuit trying to prevent the government from taking the stuff in the first place, and B, requesting compensation for a taking. The Supreme Court ruled against Nixon on his kind of executive privilege-based argument that Congress wasn't entitled, that it was unconstitutional for Congress to take the material in the first instance, but it ultimately ruled in Nixon's favor on the Fifth Amendment takings issue, although the Justice Department kind of fought back for a long time, and the Nixon people were kind of dragging their heels because I think that there were advantages to them in keeping the issue in litigation in terms of delaying the release of a lot of the materials. That may or may not be the motivation, but I suspect that that was part of why they let the case go on for so long. But I think it was about 30 years later when the Nixon estate finally did get compensation from the Justice Department. If I recall correctly, it was somewhere in the tune of $18 or $19 million. The vast, vast bulk of it, which went to fund the Nixon Library.
Mm-hmm. Which I visited.
Yeah, cool.
Of the three main characters in your film, Dwight Chapin is the survivor.
Yeah.
Did you make an attempt to interview him at all?
We did contact Dwight Chapin when we started working on the film. There was actually another Haldeman's assistant, Larry Higby, also may have shot some film. We don't know whether for sure. We don't know how much. And we wrote to him as well and didn't hear anything. Chapin did respond when we initially contacted him. I think he was very wary of what his involvement ought to be, and ultimately he decided not to be involved. And I think we were fine with that. I mean, we really felt like it was better to make the film independently without trying to negotiate that with him. And frankly, you know, we were kind of in the happy position of having an awful lot of material that we could use without asking anyone's permission, right? So we didn't have to ask anyone, you know, whether we could do this or not. It's public domain, so we can do whatever we want to. Subsequently, we have spoken to Chapin again. He appeared on a panel with Penny at AFI Docs in Washington, D.C., you know, as you might expect, he's critical of some aspects of the film. He feels like it focuses too much on Watergate and negative things about the president and doesn't say enough or doesn't reflect enough the kind of Nixon's good qualities in some sense. But I think he also recognizes, I hope he recognizes, that, you know, we intended this to be a human, empathetic portrait of him and his friends, the people he worked for, in the White House. And so, you know, hopefully he can see that the film is a balanced and considered portrait of of the administration.
I saw this film when it first aired on CNN a couple months ago. It was much better on second viewing, although I have to say I was distracted a lot by a lot of those major international public figures. Was that Suharto or Sukarno? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but Mobutu's in it as well. It's hard to recognize because you don't...
He's not as fat as he was when he died.
Yeah, and Haile Selassie.
I've met his successor.
Oh, really? And then you see a lot of Troicescu as well.
Yeah,
Nixon and Troicescu.
Oh, I wasn't sure whether that was Troicescu.
Yeah, with the wavy hair.
But it's much better on a big screen.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether there will be other opportunities like film festivals where people can see it on the big screen as opposed to on their television sets.
Well, you know, it did have a theatrical run, like a limited theatrical run in several cities. It may still be playing at a few. I know that there are some more film festivals that it's still showing in around the country, presumably through the spring at some point. It's showing in Europe as well. The DVD is coming out, and it's available streaming as well in HD. So, you know, if you have a projector at home, you could show it big that way. And, you know, if people want to do screenings, we're more than happy to facilitate that. I mean, we're delighted to see the film get to audiences there.
That's it for this week's episode of The Score. Be sure to come back in a few days to hear some reactions to the election returns. Will the predictions we heard in this week's show come to pass? We'll find out soon enough. For all the writers and editors at Bearing Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Please tell your friends where to find us, and if you feel inspired, leave comments and questions for us on our website, bearingdrift.com. The Score will return next week with more news, reviews, and interviews. But for now, remember, the 6th of November.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bearing Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit bearingdrift.com.